Philonous points out that what Hylas calls real sound, being a movement, might possibly be seen or felt, but can certainly not be heard. Therefore, it is not sound as we know it in perception. As to this, Hylas now concedes that sounds too have no real being without the mind. They now come to colours, and here Hylas begins confidently. Pardon me, the case of colours is very different. Can anything be plainer than that we see them on the objects? Substances existing without the mind, he maintains, have the colours we see on them. But Philonous has no difficulty in disposing of this view. He begins with the sunset clouds, which are red and golden, and points out that a cloud, when you are close to it, has no such colours. He goes on to the difference made by a microscope, and to the yellowness of everything to a man who has jaundice. And very small insects, he says, must be able to see much smaller objects than we can see. Hylas thereupon says that colour is not in the objects, but in the light. It is, he says, a thin, fluid substance. Philonous points out, as in the case of sound, that according to Hylas, real colours are something different from the red and blue that we see, and that this won't do. Hereupon, Hylas gives way about all secondary qualities, but continues to say that primary qualities, notably figure and motion, are inherent in external unthinking substances. To this, Philonous replies that things look big when we are near them and small when we are far off, and that a movement may seem quick to one man and slow to another. At this point, Hylas attempts a new departure. He made a mistake, he says, in not distinguishing the object from the sensation. The act of perceiving, he admits to be mental, but not what is perceived. Colours, for example, have a real existence without the mind in some unthinking substance. To this, Philonous replies that any immediate object of the senses, that is, any idea or combination of ideas, should exist in an unthinking substance, or exterior to all minds, is in itself an evident contradiction. It will be observed that, at this point, the argument becomes logical and is no longer empirical. A few pages later, Philonous says, "Whatever is immediately perceived is an idea, and can any idea exist out of the mind?" After a metaphysical discussion of substance, Hylas returns to the discussion of visual sensations, with the argument that he sees things at a distance. To this, Philonous replies that this is equally true of things seen in dreams, which everyone admits to be mental. Further, that distance is not perceived by sight, but judged as the result of experience, and that to a man born blind, but now for the first time able to see, visual objects would not appear distant. At the beginning of the second dialogue, Hylas urges that certain traces in the brain are the causes of sensations, but Philonous retorts that the brain, being a sensible thing, exists only in the mind. The remainder of the dialogues is less interesting and need not be considered. Let us now make a critical analysis of Berkeley's contentions. Berkeley's argument consists of two parts. On the one hand, he argues that we do not perceive material things, but only colours, sounds, etc., and that these are mental or in the mind. His reasoning is completely cogent as to the first point, but as to the second, it suffers from the absence of any definition of the word mental. He relies, in fact, upon the received view that everything must be either material or mental, and that nothing is both. When he says that we perceive qualities not things or material substances, and that there is no reason to suppose that the different qualities which common sense regards as all belonging to one thing inhere in a substance distinct from each and all of them, his reasoning may be accepted. But when he goes on to say that sensible qualities, including primary qualities, are mental, the arguments are of very different kinds and of very different degrees of validity. There are some attempting to prove logical necessity, while others are more empirical. Let us take the former first. Philonous says, "Whatever is immediately perceived is an idea, and can any idea exist out of the mind?" This would require a long discussion of the word idea. If it were held that thought and perception consist of a relation between subject and object, it would be possible to identify the mind with the subject and to maintain that there is nothing in the mind but only objects before it. Berkeley discusses the view that we must distinguish the act of perceiving from the object perceived, and that the former is mental while the latter is not. His argument against this view is obscure, and necessarily so, since for one who believes in mental substance, as Berkeley does, there is no valid means of refuting it. He says that any immediate object of the senses should exist in an unthinking substance, or exterior to all minds, is in itself an evident contradiction. There is here a fallacy, analogous to the following. It is impossible for a nephew to exist without an uncle. Now, Mr. A is a nephew. Therefore, it is logically necessary for Mr. A to have an uncle. It is, of course, logically necessary given that Mr. A is a nephew, but not from anything to be discovered by analysis of Mr. A. So, if something is an object of the senses, some mind is concerned with it. But it does not follow that the same thing could not have existed without being an object of the senses. There is a somewhat analogous fallacy as regards what is conceived. Hylas maintains that he can conceive a house which no one perceives and which is not in any mind. Philonous retorts that whatever Hylas conceives is in his mind, so that the supposed house is, after all, mental. Hylas should have answered, I do not mean that I have in mind the image of a house. When I say that I can conceive a house which no one perceives, what I really mean is that I can understand the proposition, there is a house which no one perceives. Or better still, there is a house which no one either perceives or conceives. This proposition is composed entirely of intelligible words, and the words are correctly put together. Whether the proposition is true or false, I do not know, but I am sure that it cannot be shown to be self-contradictory. Some closely similar propositions can be proved. For instance, the number of possible multiplications of two integers is infinite. Therefore, there are some that have never been thought of. Berkeley's argument, if valid, would prove that this is impossible. The fallacy involved is a very common one. We can, by means of concepts drawn from experience, construct statements about classes, some or all of whose members are not experienced. Take some perfectly ordinary concept, say, pebble. This is an empirical concept derived from perception. But it does not follow that all pebbles are perceived, unless we include the fact of being perceived in our definition of pebble. Unless we do this, the concept unperceived pebble is logically unobjectionable, in spite of the fact that it is logically impossible to perceive an instance of it. Schematically, the argument is as follows. Berkeley says, sensible objects must be sensible. A is a sensible object, therefore A must be sensible. But if must indicates logical necessity, the argument is only valid if A must be a sensible object. The argument does not prove that from the properties of A, other than its being sensible, it can be deduced that A is sensible. It does not prove, for example, that colours intrinsically indistinguishable from those that we see may not exist unseen. We may believe on physiological grounds that this does not occur, but such grounds are empirical. So far as logic is concerned, there is no reason why there should not be colours where there is no eye or brain. I come now to Berkeley's empirical arguments. To begin with, it is a sign of weakness to combine empirical and logical arguments, for the latter, if valid, make the former superfluous. Footnote. For example, I was not drunk last night. I had only two glasses. Besides, it is well known that I am a teetotaler. End of footnote. If I am contending that a square cannot be round, I shall not appeal to the fact that no square in any known city is round. But as we have rejected the logical arguments, it becomes necessary to consider the empirical arguments on their merits. The first of the empirical arguments is an odd one, that heat cannot be in the object because the most vehement and intense degree of heat is a very great pain, and we cannot suppose any unperceiving thing capable of pain or pleasure. There is an ambiguity in the word pain of which Berkeley takes advantage. It may mean the painful quality of a sensation, or it may mean the sensation that has this quality. We say a broken leg is painful without implying that the leg is in the mind. It might be, similarly, that heat causes pain, and that this is all we ought to mean when we say it is a pain. This argument, therefore, is a poor one. The argument about the hot and cold hands in lukewarm water, strictly speaking, would only prove that what we perceive in that experiment is not hot and cold, but hotter and colder. There is nothing to prove that these are subjective. In regard to tastes, the argument from pleasure and pain is repeated. Sweetness is a pleasure and bitterness a pain, therefore both are mental. It is also urged that a thing that tastes sweet when I am well may taste bitter when I am ill. Very similar arguments are used about odors. Since they are pleasant or unpleasant, they cannot exist in any but a perceiving substance or mind. Berkeley assumes, here and everywhere, that what does not inhere in matter must inhere in a mental substance, and that nothing can be both mental and material. The argument in regard to sound is ad hominem. Hylas says that sounds are really motions in the air, and Philonous retorts that motions can be seen or felt, not heard, so that real sounds are unaudible. This is hardly a fair argument, since percepts of motion, according to Berkeley, are just as subjective as other percepts. The motions that Hylas requires will have to be unperceived and imperceptible. Nevertheless, it is valid insofar as it points out that sound, as heard, cannot be identified with the motions of air that physics regards as its cause. Hylas, after abandoning secondary qualities, is not yet ready to abandon primary qualities, viz. Extension, figure, solidity, gravity, motion, and rest. The argument, naturally, concentrates on extension and motion. If things have real sizes, says Philonous, the same thing cannot be of different sizes at the same time, and yet it looks larger when we are near it than when we are far off. And if motion is really in the object, how comes it that the same motion may seem fast to one and slow to another? Such arguments must, I think, be allowed to prove the subjectivity of perceived space. But this subjectivity is physical. It is equally true of a camera, and therefore does not prove that shape is mental. In the second dialogue, Philonous sums up the discussion so far as it has gone in the words, "Besides spirits, all that we know or conceive are our own ideas." He ought not, of course, to make an exception for spirits, since it is just as impossible to know spirit as to know matter. The arguments, in fact, are almost identical in both cases. Let us now try to state what positive conclusions we can reach as a result of the kind of argument inaugurated by Berkeley. Things as we know them are bundles of sensible qualities. A table, for example, consists of its visual shape, its hardness, the noise it emits when rapped, and its smell, if any. These different qualities have certain contiguities in experience, which lead common sense to regard them as belonging to one thing, but the concept of thing or substance adds nothing to the perceived qualities and is unnecessary. So far, we are on firm ground. But we must now ask ourselves what we mean by perceiving. Philonous maintains that, as regards sensible things, their reality consists in their being perceived. But he does not tell us what he means by perception. There is a theory, which he rejects, that perception is a relation between a subject and a percept. Since he believed the ego to be a substance, he might well have adopted this theory. However, he decided against it. For those who reject the notion of a substantial ego, this theory is impossible. What then is meant by calling something a percept? Does it mean anything more than that the something in question occurs? Can we turn Berkeley's dictum round and, instead of saying that reality consists in being perceived, say that being perceived consists in being real? However this may be, Berkeley holds it logically possible that there should be unperceived things, since he holds that some real things, viz. Spiritual substances, are unperceived. And it seems obvious that, when we say that an event is perceived, we mean something more than it occurs. What is this more? One obvious difference between perceived and unperceived events is that the former, but not the latter, can be remembered. Is there any other difference? Recollection is one of a whole genus of effects which are more or less peculiar to the phenomena that we naturally call mental. These effects are connected with habit. A burnt child fears the fire. A burnt poker does not. The physiologist, however, deals with habit and kindred matters as a characteristic of nervous tissue and has no need to depart from a physicalist interpretation. In physicalist language, we can say that an occurrence is perceived if it has effects of certain kinds. In this sense, we might almost say that a watercourse perceives the rain by which it is deepened, and that a river valley is a memory of former downpours. Habit and memory, when described in physicalist terms, are not wholly absent in dead matter. The difference in this respect between living and dead matter is only one of degree. In this view, to say that an event is perceived is to say that it has effects of certain kinds, and there is no reason, either logical or empirical, for supposing that all events have effects of these kinds. Theory of knowledge suggests a different standpoint. We start here not from finished science, but from whatever knowledge is the ground for our belief in science. This is what Berkeley is doing. Here, it is not necessary in advance to define a percept. The method in outline is as follows. We collect the propositions that we feel we know without inference, and we find that most of these have to do with dated particular events. These events we define as percepts. Percepts, therefore, are those events that we know without inference. Or at least, to allow for memory, such events were at some time percepts. We are then faced with the question, can we, from our own percepts, infer any other events? Here, four positions are possible, of which the first three are forms of idealism. 1. We may deny totally the validity of all inferences, from my present percepts and memories, to other events. This view must be taken by anyone who confines inference to deduction. Any event, and any group of events, is logically capable of standing alone, and therefore no group of events affords demonstrative proof of the existence of other events. If, therefore, we confine inference to deduction, the known world is confined to those events in our own biography that we perceive, or have perceived, if memory is admitted. 2. The second position, which is solipsism as ordinarily understood, allows some inference from my percepts, but only to other events in my own biography. Take, for example, the view that, at any moment in waking life, there are sensible objects that we do not notice. We see many things without saying to ourselves that we see them, at least so it seems. Keeping the eyes fixed in an environment in which we perceive no movement, we can notice various things in succession, and we feel persuaded that they were visible before we noticed them. But before we noticed them, they were not data for theory of knowledge. This degree of inference from what we observe is made unreflectingly by everybody, even by those who most wish to avoid an undue extension of our knowledge beyond experience. 3. The third position, which seems to be held, for instance, by Eddington, is that it is possible to make inferences to other events analogous to those in our own experience, and that, therefore, we have a right to believe that there are, for instance, colours seen by other people but not by ourselves, toothaches felt by other people, pleasures enjoyed and pains endured by other people, and so on. But that we have no right to infer events experienced by no one and not forming part of any mind. This view may be defended on the ground that all inference to events which lie outside my observation is by analogy, and that events which no one experiences are not sufficiently analogous to my data to warrant analogical inferences. 4. The fourth position is that of common sense and traditional physics, according to which there are, in addition to my own experiences and other people's, also events which no one experiences. For example, the furniture of my bedroom when I am asleep and it is pitch dark. G.E. Moore once accused idealists of holding that trains only have wheels while they are in stations, on the ground that passengers cannot see the wheels while they remain in the train. Common sense refuses to believe that the wheels suddenly spring into being whenever you look, but do not bother to exist when no one is inspecting them. When this point of view is scientific, it bases the inference to unperceived events on causal laws. I do not propose at present to decide between these four points of view. The decision, if possible at all, can only be made by an elaborate investigation of non-demonstrative inference
and the theory of probability.
What I do propose to do is to point out certain logical errors which have been committed by those who have discussed these questions. Berkeley, as we have seen, thinks that there are logical reasons proving that only minds and mental events can exist. This view, on other grounds, is also held by Hegel and his followers. I believe this to be a complete mistake. Such a statement as, "There was a time before life existed on this planet," whether true or false, cannot be condemned on grounds of logic, any more than, "There are multiplication sums which no one will have ever worked out." To be observed, or to be a percept, is merely to have effects of certain kinds, and there is no logical reason why all events should have effects of these kinds. There is, however, another kind of argument, which, while it does not establish idealism as a metaphysic, does, if valid, establish it as a practical policy. It is said that a proposition which is unverifiable has no meaning, that verification depends upon percepts, and that, therefore, a proposition about anything except actual or possible percepts is meaningless. I think that this view, strictly interpreted, would confine us to the first of the above four theories, and would forbid us to speak about anything that we have not ourselves explicitly noticed. If so, it is a view that no one can hold in practice, which is a defect in a theory that is advocated on practical grounds. The whole question of verification and its connection with knowledge is difficult and complex. I will, therefore, leave it on one side for the present. The fourth of the above theories, which admits events that no one perceives, may also be defended by invalid arguments. It may be held that causality is known a priori and that causal laws are impossible unless there are unperceived events. As against this, it may be urged that causality is not a priori, and that whatever regularity can be observed must be in relation to percepts. Whatever there is reason to believe in the laws of physics must, it would seem, be capable of being stated in terms of percepts. The statement may be odd and complicated. It may lack the characteristic of continuity which until lately was expected of a physical law, but it can hardly be impossible. I conclude that there is no a priori objection to any of our four theories. It is possible, however, to say that all truth is pragmatic, and that there is no pragmatic difference between the four theories. If this is true, we can adopt whichever we please, and the difference between them is only linguistic. I cannot accept this view, but this also is a matter for discussion at a later stage. It remains to be asked whether any meaning can be attached to the words mind and matter. Everyone knows that mind is what an idealist thinks there is nothing else but, and matter is what a materialist thinks the same about. The reader knows also, I hope, that idealists are virtuous and materialists are wicked, but perhaps there may be more than this to be said. My own definition of matter may seem unsatisfactory. I should define it as what satisfies the equations of physics. There may be nothing satisfying these equations. In that case, either physics or the concept matter is a mistake. If we reject substance, matter will have to be a logical construction. Whether it can be any construction composed of events, which may be partly inferred, is a difficult question, but by no means an insoluble one. As for mind, when substance has been rejected, a mind must be some group or structure of events. The grouping must be affected by some relation which is characteristic of the sort of phenomena we wish to call mental. We may take memory as typical. We might, though this would be rather unduly simple, define a mental event as one which remembers or is remembered. Then the mind, to which a given mental event belongs, is the group of events connected with the given event by memory chains, backwards or forwards. It will be seen that, according to the above definitions, a mind and a piece of matter are, each of them, a group of events. There is no reason why every event should belong to a group of one kind or the other, and there is no reason why some events should not belong to both groups. Therefore, some events may be neither mental nor material, and other events may be both. As to this, only detailed empirical considerations can decide. Chapter 17. Hume. David Hume, 1711 to 76, is one of the most important among philosophers, because he developed to its logical conclusion the empirical philosophy of Locke and Berkeley, and by making it self-consistent, made it incredible. He represents, in a certain sense, a dead end. In his direction, it is impossible to go further. To refute him has been, ever since he wrote, a favorite pastime among metaphysicians. For my part, I find none of their refutations convincing. Nevertheless, I cannot but hope that something less skeptical than Hume's system may be discoverable. His chief philosophical work, The Treatise of Human Nature, was written while he was living in France during the years 1734 to 1737. The first two volumes were published in 1739, the third in 1740. He was a very young man, not yet in his 30s. He was not well known, and his conclusions were such as almost all schools would find unwelcome. He hoped for vehement attacks, which he would meet with brilliant retorts. Instead, no one noticed the book. As he says himself, it fell dead born from the press. But, he adds, being naturally of a cheerful and sanguine temper, I very soon recovered from the blow. He devoted himself to the writing of essays, of which he produced the first volume in 1741. In 1744, he made an unsuccessful attempt to obtain a professorship at Edinburgh. Having failed in this, he became first tutor to a lunatic, and then secretary to a general. Fortified by these credentials, he ventured again into philosophy. He shortened the treatise by leaving out the best parts and most of the reasons for his conclusions. The result was The Inquiry into Human Understanding, for a long time much better known than the treatise. It was this book that awakened Kant from his dogmatic slumbers. He does not appear to have known the treatise. He wrote also Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which he kept unpublished during his lifetime. By his direction, they were published posthumously in 1779. His Essay on Miracles, which became famous, maintains that there never can be adequate historical evidence for such events. His History of England, published in 1755 and following years, devoted itself to proving the superiority of Tories to Whigs and of Scotchmen to Englishmen. He did not consider history worthy of philosophic detachment. He visited Paris in 1763 and was made much of by the philosophes. Unfortunately, he formed a friendship with Rousseau and had a famous quarrel with him. Hume behaved with admirable forbearance, but Rousseau, who suffered from persecution mania, insisted upon a violent breach. Hume has described his own character in a self-obituary, or funeral oration, as he calls it. I was a man of mild dispositions, of command of temper, of an open, social, and cheerful humour, capable of attachment but little susceptible of enmity, and of great moderation in all my passions. Even my love of literary fame, my ruling passion, never soured my temper, notwithstanding my frequent disappointments. All this is borne out by everything that is known of him. Hume's Treatise of Human Nature is divided into three books, dealing respectively with the understanding, the passions, and morals. What is important and novel in his doctrines is in the first book, to which I shall confine myself. He begins with the distinction between impressions and ideas. These are two kinds of perceptions, of which impressions are those that have more force and violence. By ideas, I mean the faint images of these in thinking and reasoning. Ideas, at least when simple, are like impressions, but fainter. Every simple idea has a simple impression, which resembles it, and every simple impression a correspondent idea. All our simple ideas, in their first appearance, are derived from simple impressions, which are correspondent to them, and which they exactly represent. Complex ideas, on the other hand, do not resemble impressions. We can imagine a winged horse without having ever seen one, but the constituents of this complex idea are all derived from impressions. The proof that impressions come first is derived from experience. For example, a man born blind has no ideas of colours. Among ideas, those that retain a considerable degree of the vivacity of the original impressions belong to memory, the others to imagination. There is a section of abstract ideas which opens with a paragraph of emphatic agreement with Berkeley's doctrine that all general ideas are nothing but particular ones, annexed to a certain term, which gives them a more extensive significance and makes them recall upon occasion other individuals which are similar to them. He contends that when we have an idea of a man, it has all the particularity that the impression of a man has. The mind cannot form any notion of quantity or quality without forming a precise notion of degrees of each. Abstract ideas are in themselves individual, however, they may become general in their representation. This theory, which is a modern form of nominalism, has two defects, one logical, the other psychological. To begin with the logical objection, when we have found a resemblance among several objects, Hume says, we apply the same name to all of them. Every nominalist would agree. But in fact, a common name, such as cat, is just as unreal as the universal cat is. The nominalist solution of the problem of universals thus fails through being insufficiently drastic in the application of its own principles. It mistakenly applies these principles only to things and not also to words. The psychological objection is more serious, at least in connection with Hume. The whole theory of ideas as copies of impressions, as he sets it forth, suffers from ignoring vagueness. When, for example, I have seen a flower of a certain colour, and I afterwards call up an image of it, the image is lacking in precision, in this sense that there are several closely similar shades of colour of which it might be an image or idea in Hume's terminology. It is not true that the mind cannot form any notion of quantity or quality without forming a precise notion of degrees of each. Suppose you have seen a man whose height is 6 feet 1 inch. You retain an image of him, but it probably would fit a man half an inch taller or shorter. Vagueness is different from generality, but has some of the same characteristics. By not noticing it, Hume runs into unnecessary difficulties. For instance, as to the possibility of imagining a shade of colour you have never seen, which is intermediate between two closely similar shades that you have seen. If these two are sufficiently similar, any image you can form will be equally applicable to both of them and to the intermediate shade. When Hume says that ideas are derived from impressions which they exactly represent, he goes beyond what is psychologically true. Hume banished the conception of substance from psychology, as Berkeley had banished it from physics. There is, he says, no impression of self, and therefore no idea of self. For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other, of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I never catch myself at any time without a perception, and never can observe anything but the perception. There may, he ironically concedes, be some philosophers who can perceive themselves. But setting aside some metaphysicians of this kind, I may venture to affirm of the rest of mankind that they are nothing but a bundle or collection of different perceptions, which succeed each other with inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement. This repudiation of the idea of the self is of great importance. Let us see exactly what it maintains and how far it is valid. To begin with, the self, if there is such a thing, is never perceived, and therefore we can have no idea of it. If this argument is to be accepted, it must be carefully stated. No man perceives his own brain, yet in an important sense he has an idea of it. Such ideas, which are inferences from perceptions, are not among the logically basic stock of ideas. They are complex and descriptive. This must be the case if Hume is right in his principle, that all simple ideas are derived from impressions, and if this principle is rejected, we are forced back on innate ideas. Using modern terminology, we may say, ideas of unperceived things or occurrences can always be defined in terms of perceived things or occurrences. And therefore, by substituting the definition for the term defined, we can always state what we know empirically without introducing any unperceived things or occurrences. As regards our present problem, all psychological knowledge can be stated without introducing the self. Further, the self, as defined, can be nothing but a bundle of perceptions, not a new, simple thing. In this, I think that any thoroughgoing empiricist must agree with Hume. It does not follow that there is no simple self. It only follows that we cannot know whether there is or not, and that the self, except as a bundle of perceptions, cannot enter into any part of our knowledge. This conclusion is important in metaphysics as getting rid of the last surviving use of substance. It is important in theology as abolishing all supposed knowledge of the soul. It is important in the analysis of knowledge, since it shows that the category of subject and object is not fundamental. In this matter of the ego, Hume made an important advance on Berkeley. The most important part of the whole treatise is the section called Of Knowledge and Probability. Hume does not mean by probability the sort of knowledge contained in the mathematical theory of probability, such as that the chance of throwing double sixes with two dice is 1/36. This knowledge is not itself probable in any special sense. It has as much certainty as knowledge can have. What Hume is concerned with is uncertain knowledge, such as is obtained from empirical data by inferences that are not demonstrative. This includes all our knowledge as to the future and as to unobserved portions of the past and present. In fact, it includes everything except, on the one hand, direct observation, and on the other, logic and mathematics. The analysis of such probable knowledge led Hume to certain skeptical conclusions, which are equally difficult to refute and to accept. The result was a challenge to philosophers, which, in my opinion, has still not been adequately met. Hume begins by distinguishing seven kinds of philosophical relation: resemblance, identity, relations of time and place, proportion in quantity or number, degrees in inequality, contrariety, and causation. These, he says, may be divided into two kinds: those that depend only on the ideas, and those that can be changed without any change in the ideas. Of the first kind are resemblance, contrariety, degrees in quality, and proportions in quantity or number. But spatio-temporal and causal relations are of the second kind. Only relations of the first kind give certain knowledge. Our knowledge concerning the others is only probable. Algebra and arithmetic are the only sciences in which we can carry on a long chain of reasoning without losing certainty. Geometry is not so certain as algebra and arithmetic because we cannot be sure of the truth of its axioms. It is a mistake to suppose, as many philosophers do, that the ideas of mathematics must be comprehended by a pure and intellectual view of which the superior faculties of the soul are alone capable. The falsehood of this view is evident, says Hume, as soon as we remember that all our ideas are copied from our impressions. The three relations that depend not only on ideas are identity, spatio-temporal relations, and causation. In the first two, the mind does not go beyond what is immediately present to the senses. Spatio-temporal relations, Hume holds, can be perceived and can form parts of impressions. Causation alone enables us to infer something or occurrence from some other thing or occurrence. It is only causation which produces such a connection as to give us assurance from the existence or action of one object that 'twas followed or preceded by any other existence or action. A difficulty arises from Hume's contention that there is no such thing as an impression of a causal relation. We can perceive, by mere observation of A and B, that A is above B or to the right of B, but not that A causes B. In the past, the relation of causation had been more or less assimilated to that of ground and consequent in logic, but this, Hume rightly perceived, was a mistake. In the Cartesian philosophy, as in that of the Scholastics, the connection of cause and effect was supposed to be necessary, as logical connections are necessary. The first really serious challenge to this view came from Hume, with whom the modern philosophy of causation begins. He, in common with almost all philosophers, down to and including Bergson, supposes the law to state that there are propositions of the form A causes B, where A and B are classes of events. The fact that such laws do not occur in any well-developed science appears to be unknown to philosophers. But much of what they have said can be translated so as to be applicable to causal laws such as do occur. We may therefore ignore this point for the present. Hume begins by observing that the power by which one object produces another is not discoverable from the ideas of the two objects, and that we can therefore only know cause and effect from experience, not from reasoning or reflection. The statement, "What begins must have a cause," he says, is not one that has intuitive certainty, like the statements of logic. As he puts it, "There is no object which implies the existence of any other, if we consider these objects in themselves, and never look beyond the ideas which we form of them." Hume argues from this that it must be experience that gives knowledge of cause and effect, but that it cannot be merely the experience of the two events A and B, which are in a causal relation to each other. It must be experience because the connection is not logical, and it cannot be merely the experience of the particular events A and B, since we can discover nothing in A by itself which should lead it to produce B. The experience required, he says, is that of the constant conjunction of events of the kind A with events of the kind B. He points out that when, in experience, two objects are constantly conjoined, we do, in fact, infer one from the other. When he says infer, he means that perceiving the one makes us expect the other. He does not mean a formal or explicit inference. Perhaps the necessary connection depends on the inference, not vice versa. That is to say, the sight of A causes the expectation of B, and so leads us to believe that there is a necessary connection between A and B. The inference is not determined by reason, since that would require us to assume the uniformity of nature, which itself is not necessary, but only inferred from experience. Hume is thus led to the view that, when we say A causes B, we mean only that A and B are constantly conjoined in fact, not that there is some necessary connection between them. We have no other notion of cause and effect but that of certain objects which have been always conjoined together. We cannot penetrate into the reason of the conjunction. He backs up his theory with a definition of belief, which is, he maintains, a lively idea related to or associated with a present impression. Through association, if A and B have been constantly conjoined in past experience, the impression of A produces that lively idea of B which constitutes belief in B. This explains why we believe A and B to be connected. The percept of A is connected with the idea of B, and so we come to think that A is connected with B, though this opinion is really groundless. Objects have no discoverable connection together, nor is it from any other principle but custom operating upon the imagination that we can draw any inference from the appearance of one to the experience of another. He repeats many times the contention that what appears to us as necessary connection among objects is really only connection among the ideas of those objects. The mind is determined by custom, and 'tis this impression or determination which affords me the idea of necessity. The repetition of instances, which leads us to the belief that A causes B, gives nothing new in the object, but in the mind leads to an association of ideas. Thus, necessity is something that exists in the mind, not in objects. Let us now ask ourselves what we are to think of Hume's doctrine. It has two parts, one objective, the other subjective. The objective part says, when we judge that A causes B, what has in fact happened, so far as A and B are concerned, is that they have been frequently observed to be conjoined. That is, A has been immediately, or very quickly, followed by B. We have no right to say that A must be followed by B, or will be followed by B on future occasions. Nor have we any ground for supposing that however often A is followed by B, any relation beyond sequence is involved. In fact, causation is definable in terms of sequence and is not an independent notion. The subjective part of the doctrine says, the frequently observed conjunction of A and B causes the impression of A to cause the idea of B. But if we are to define cause as is suggested in the objective part of the doctrine, we must reword the above. Substituting the definition of cause, the above becomes, it has been frequently observed that the frequently observed conjunction of two objects, A and B, has been frequently followed by occasions on which the impression of A was followed by the idea of B. This statement, we may admit, is true, but it has hardly the scope that Hume attributes to the subjective part of his doctrine. He contends over and over again that the frequent conjunction of A and B gives no reason for expecting them to be conjoined in the future, but is merely a cause of this expectation. That is to say, experience of frequent conjunction is frequently conjoined with a habit of association. But if the objective part of Hume's doctrine is accepted, the fact that, in the past, associations have been frequently formed in such circumstances is no reason for supposing that they will continue, or that new ones will be formed in similar circumstances. The fact is that, where psychology is concerned, Hume allows himself to believe in causation in a sense which, in general, he condemns. Let us take an illustration. I see an apple, and expect that, if I eat it, I shall experience a certain kind of taste. According to Hume, there is no reason why I should experience this kind of taste. The law of habit explains the existence of my expectation, but does not justify it. But the law of habit is itself a causal law. Therefore, if we take Hume seriously, we must say, although in the past the sight of an apple has been conjoined with expectation of a certain kind of taste, there is no reason
for it, Kraft, not that he would have.
Perhaps the next time I see an apple, I shall expect it to taste like roast beef. You may at the moment think this unlikely, but that is no reason for expecting that you will think it unlikely 5 minutes hence. If Hume's objective doctrine is right, we have no better reason for expectations in psychology than in the physical world. Hume's theory might be caricatured as follows. The proposition A causes B means the impression of A causes the idea of B. As a definition, this is not a happy effort. We must therefore examine Hume's objective doctrine more closely. This doctrine has two parts. One, when we say A causes B, all that we have a right to say is that, in past experience, A and B have frequently appeared together or in rapid succession, and no instance has been observed of A not followed or accompanied by B. Two, however many instances we may have observed of the conjunction of A and B, that gives no reason for expecting them to be conjoined on a future occasion, though it is a cause of this expectation, that is, it has been frequently observed to be conjoined with such an expectation. These two parts of the doctrine may be stated as follows. 1. In causation, there is no indefinable relation except conjunction or succession. 2. Induction by simple enumeration is not a valid form of argument. Empiricists in general have accepted the first of these theses and rejected the second. When I say they have rejected the second, I mean that they have believed that, given a sufficiently vast accumulation of instances of a conjunction, the likelihood of the conjunction being found in the next instance will exceed a half. Or, if they have not held exactly this, they have maintained some doctrine having similar consequences. I do not wish at the moment to discuss induction, which is a large and difficult subject. For the moment, I am content to observe that, if the first half of Hume's doctrine is admitted, the rejection of induction makes all expectation as to the future irrational, even the expectation that we shall continue to feel expectations. I do not mean merely that our expectations may be mistaken, that in any case must be admitted. I mean that, taking even our firmest expectations, such as that the sun will rise tomorrow, there is not a shadow of a reason for supposing them more likely to be verified than not. With this proviso, I return to the meaning of cause. Those who disagree with Hume maintain that cause is a specific relation, which entails invariable sequence, but is not entailed by it. To revert to the clocks of the Cartesians, two perfectly accurate chronometers might strike the hours one after the other invariably, without either being the cause of the other's striking. In general, those who take this view maintain that we can sometimes perceive causal relations, though in most cases we are obliged to infer them, more or less precariously, from constant conjunction. Let us see what arguments there are for and against Hume on this point. Hume summarizes his argument as follows. I am sensible that of all the paradoxes which I have had or shall hereafter have occasion to advance in the course of this treatise, the present one is the most violent, and that 'tis merely by dint of solid proof and reasoning I can ever hope it will have admission, and overcome the inveterate prejudices of mankind. Before we are reconciled to this doctrine, how often must we repeat to ourselves that the simple view of any two objects or actions, however related, can never give us any idea of power or of a connection betwixt them, that this idea arises from a repetition of their union, that the repetition neither discovers nor causes anything in the objects, but has influence only on the mind by that customary transition it produces, that this customary transition is therefore the same with the power and necessity which are consequently felt by the soul and not perceived externally in bodies. Hume is commonly accused of having too atomic a view of perception, but he allows that certain relations can be perceived. We ought not, he says, to receive as reasoning any of the observations we make concerning identity and the relations of time and place, since in none of them the mind can go beyond what is immediately present to the senses. Causation, he says, is different in that it takes us beyond the impressions of our senses and informs us of unperceived existences. As an argument, this seems invalid. We believe in many relations of time and place which we cannot perceive. We think that time extends backwards and forwards, and space beyond the walls of our room. Hume's real argument is that, while we sometimes perceive relations of time and place, we never perceive causal relations, which must therefore, if admitted, be inferred from relations that can be perceived. The controversy is thus reduced to one of empirical fact. Do we, or do we not, sometimes perceive a relation which can be called causal? Hume says no, his adversaries say yes, and it is not easy to see how evidence can be produced by either side. I think perhaps the strongest argument on Hume's side is to be derived from the character of causal laws in physics. It appears that simple rules of the form A causes B are never to be admitted in science except as crude suggestions in early stages. The causal laws by which such simple rules are replaced in well-developed sciences are so complex that no one can suppose them given in perception. They are all, obviously, elaborate inferences from the observed course of nature. I am leaving out of account modern quantum theory, which reinforces the above conclusion. So far as the physical sciences are concerned, Hume is wholly in the right. Such propositions as A causes B are never to be accepted, and our inclination to accept them is to be explained by the laws of habit and association. These laws themselves, in their accurate form, will be elaborate statements as to nervous tissue, primarily its physiology, then its chemistry, and ultimately its physics. The opponent of Hume, however, even if he admits the whole of what has just been said about the physical sciences, may not yet admit himself decisively defeated. He may say that in psychology we have cases where a causal relation can be perceived. The whole conception of cause is probably derived from volition, and it may be said that we can perceive a relation between a volition and the consequent act, which is something more than invariable sequence. The same might be said of the relation between a sudden pain and a cry. Such views, however, are rendered very difficult by physiology. Between the will to move my arm and the consequent movement, there is a long chain of causal intermediaries consisting of processes in the nerves and muscles. We perceive only the end terms of this process, the volition and the movement, and if we think we see a direct causal connection between these, we are mistaken. This argument is not conclusive on the general question, but it shows that it is rash to suppose that we perceive causal relations when we think we do. The balance, therefore, is in favor of Hume's view that there is nothing in cause except in variable succession. The evidence, however, is not so conclusive as Hume supposed. Hume is not content with reducing the evidence of a causal connection to experience of frequent conjunction. He proceeds to argue that such experience does not justify the expectation of similar conjunctions in the future. For example, when, to repeat a former illustration, I see an apple, Past experience makes me expect that it will taste like an apple and not like roast beef. But there is no rational justification for this expectation. If there were such a justification, it would have to proceed from the principle that those instances of which we have had no experience resemble those of which we have had experience. This principle is not logically necessary, since we can at least conceive a change in the course of nature. It should therefore be a principle of probability. But all probable arguments assume this principle, and therefore it cannot itself be proved by any probable argument, or even rendered probable by any such argument. The supposition that the future resembles the past is not founded on arguments of any kind, but is derived entirely from habit. The conclusion is one of complete skepticism. All probable reasoning is nothing but a species of sensation. 'Tis not solely in poetry and music we must follow our taste and sentiment, but likewise in philosophy. When I am convinced of any principle, 'tis only an idea which strikes more strongly upon me. When I give the preference to one set of arguments above another, I do nothing but decide from my feeling concerning the superiority of their influence. Objects have no discoverable connection together, nor is it from any other principle but custom operating upon the imagination that we can draw any inference from the appearance of one to the existence of another.
The ultimate outcome of Hume's investigation of what passes for knowledge is not what we must suppose him to have desired.
The subtitle of his book is An Attempt to Introduce the Experimental Method of Reasoning into Moral Subjects. It is evident that he started out with a belief that scientific method yields the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. He ended, however, with the conviction that belief is never rational, since we know nothing. After setting forth the arguments for skepticism, he goes on not to refute the arguments, but to fall back on natural credulity. Nature, by an absolute and uncontrollable necessity, has determined us to judge as well as to breathe and feel. Nor can we any more forbear viewing certain objects in a stronger and fuller light upon account of their customary connection with a present impression than we can hinder ourselves from thinking as long as we are awake or seeing the surrounding bodies when we turn our eyes towards them in broad sunshine. Whoever has taken the pains to refute this total skepticism has really disputed without an antagonist, and endeavoured by arguments to establish a faculty which nature has antecedently implanted in the mind and rendered unavoidable. My intention, then, in displaying so carefully the arguments of that fantastic sect, is only to make the reader sensible of the truth of my hypothesis, that all our reasonings concerning causes and effects are derived from nothing but custom, and that belief is more properly an act of the sensitive than of the cogitative part of our natures. The skeptic, he continues, still continues to reason and believe, even though he asserts that he cannot defend his reason by reason, and by the same rule he must assent to the principle concerning the existence of body, though he cannot pretend by any arguments of philosophy to maintain its veracity. We may well ask, what causes us to believe in the existence of body? But 'tis vain to ask whether there be body or not. That is a point which we must take for granted in all our reasonings. The above is the beginning of a section of skepticism with regard to the senses. After a long discussion, this section ends with the following conclusion. This skeptical doubt, both with respect to reason and the senses, is a malady, which can never be radically cured, but must return upon us every moment, however we may chase it away, and sometimes may seem entirely free from it. Carelessness and inattention alone can afford us any remedy. For this reason, I rely entirely upon them, and take it for granted, whatever may be the reader's opinion at this present moment, that an hour hence he will be persuaded there is both an external and internal world. There is no reason for studying philosophy, so Hume maintains, except that, to certain temperaments, this is an agreeable way of passing the time. In all the incidents of life, we ought still to preserve our skepticism. If we believe that fire warms or water refreshes, 'tis only because it costs us too much pains to think otherwise.
Nay, if we are philosophers, it ought only to be upon sceptical principles, and from an inclination which we feel to be employing ourselves after that manner. If he abandoned speculation, I feel I should be a loser in point of pleasure, and this is the origin of my philosophy. Hume's philosophy, whether true or false, represents the bankruptcy of 18th century reasonableness. He starts out, like Locke, with the intention of being sensible and empirical, taking nothing on trust, but seeking whatever instruction is to be obtained from experience and observation. But having a better intellect than Locke's, a greater acuteness in analysis, and a smaller capacity for accepting comfortable inconsistencies, he arrives at the disastrous conclusion that from experience and observation nothing is to be learnt. There is no such thing as a rational belief. If we believe that fire warms or water refreshes, 'tis only because it costs us too much pains to think otherwise. We cannot help believing, but no belief can be grounded in reason. Nor can one line of action be more rational than another, since all alike are based upon irrational convictions. This last conclusion, however, Hume seems not to have drawn. Even in his most sceptical chapter, in which he sums up the conclusions of Book I, he says, "Generally speaking, the errors in religion are dangerous, those in philosophy only ridiculous." He has no right to say this. Dangerous is a causal word, and a sceptic as to causation cannot know that anything is dangerous. In fact, in the later portions of the treatise, Hume forgets all about his fundamental doubts, and writes much as any other enlightened moralist of his time might have written. He applies to his doubts the remedy that he recommends, namely, carelessness and inattention. In a sense, his scepticism is insincere, since he cannot maintain it in practice. It has, however, this awkward consequence that it paralyzes every effort to prove one line of action better than another. It was inevitable that such a self-refutation of rationality should be followed by a great outburst of irrational faith. The quarrel between Hume and Rousseau is symbolic. Rousseau was mad, but influential. Hume was sane, but had no followers. Subsequent British empiricists rejected his scepticism without refuting it. Rousseau and his followers agreed with Hume that no belief is based on reason, but thought the heart superior to reason, and allowed it to lead them to convictions very different from those that Hume retained in practice. German philosophers, from Kant to Hegel, had not assimilated Hume's arguments. I say this deliberately, in spite of the belief which many philosophers share with Kant that his Critique of Pure Reason answered Hume. In fact, these philosophers, at least Kant and Hegel, represent a pre-Humean type of rationalism and can be refuted by Humean arguments. The philosophers who cannot be refuted in this way are those who do not pretend to be rational, such as Rousseau, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche. The growth of unreason throughout the 19th century and what has passed of the 20th is a natural sequel to Hume's destruction of empiricism. It is therefore important to discover whether there is any answer to Hume within the framework of a philosophy that is wholly or mainly empirical. If not, there is no intellectual difference between sanity and insanity. The lunatic who believes that he is a poached egg is to be condemned solely on the ground that he is in a minority, or rather, since we must not assume democracy, on the ground that the government does not agree with him. This is a desperate point of view, and it must be hoped that there is some way of escaping from it. Hume's scepticism rests entirely upon his rejection of the principle of induction. The principle of induction, as applied to causation, says that if A has been found very often accompanied or followed by B, and no instance is known of A not being accompanied or followed by B, then it is probable that on the next occasion on which A is observed, it will be accompanied or followed by B. If the principle is to be adequate, a sufficient number of instances must make the probability not far short of certainty. If this principle, or any other from which it can be deduced, is true, then the causal inferences which Hume rejects are valid, not indeed as giving certainty, but as giving a sufficient probability for practical purposes. If this principle is not true, every attempt to arrive at general scientific laws from particular observations is fallacious, and Hume's scepticism is inescapable for an empiricist. The principle itself cannot, of course, without circularity, be inferred from observed uniformities, since it is required to justify any such inference. It must therefore be, or be deduced from, an independent principle not based upon experience. To this extent, Hume has proved that pure empiricism is not a sufficient basis for science. But if this one principle is admitted, everything else can proceed in accordance with the theory that all our knowledge is based on experience. It must be granted that this is a serious departure from pure empiricism, and that those who are not empiricists may ask why, if one departure is allowed, others are to be forbidden. These, however, are questions not directly raised by Hume's arguments. What these arguments prove, and I do not think the proof can be controverted, is that induction is an independent logical principle, incapable of being inferred either from experience or from other logical principles, and that without this principle, science is impossible. Part 2. From Rousseau to the Present Day. Chapter 18. The Romantic Movement. From the latter part of the 18th century to the present day, art and literature and philosophy and even politics have been influenced, positively or negatively, by a way of feeling which was characteristic of what, in a large sense, may be called the Romantic Movement. Even those who were repelled by this way of feeling were compelled to take account of it, and in many cases were more affected by it than they knew. I propose in this chapter to give a brief description of the Romantic outlook, chiefly in matters not definitely philosophical, for this is the cultural background of most philosophic thought in the period with which we are now to be concerned. The Romantic movement was not, in its beginnings, connected with philosophy, though it came before long to have connections with it. With politics, through Rousseau, it was connected from the first. But before we can understand its political and philosophical effects, we must consider it in its most essential form, which is as a revolt against received ethical and aesthetic standards. The first great figure in the movement is Rousseau, but to some extent he only expressed already existing tendencies. Cultivated people in 18th century France greatly admired what they called la sensibilité, which meant a proneness to emotion, and more particularly to the emotion of sympathy. To be thoroughly satisfactory, the emotion must be direct and violent and quite uninformed by thought. The man of sensibility would be moved to tears by the sight of a single destitute peasant family, but would be cold to well-thought-out schemes for ameliorating the lot of peasants as a class. The poor were supposed to possess more virtue than the rich. The sage was thought of as a man who retires from the corruption of courts to enjoy the peaceful pleasures of an unambitious rural existence. As a passing mood, this attitude is to be found in poets of almost all periods. The exiled duke in As You Like It expresses it, though he goes back to his dukedom as soon as he can. Only the melancholy Jaques sincerely prefers the life of the forest. Even Pope, the perfect exemplar of all that the Romantic movement rebelled against, says, "Happy the man whose wish and care a few paternal acres bound, content to breathe his native air on his own ground." The poor, in the imaginations of those who cultivated sensibility, always had a few paternal acres, and lived on the produce of their own labour without the need of external commerce. True, they were always losing the acres in pathetic circumstances, because the aged father could no longer work, the lovely daughter was going into a decline, and the wicked mortgagee or the wicked lord was ready to pounce either on the acres or on the daughter's virtue. The poor, to the Romantics, were never urban and never industrial. The proletariat is a 19th century conception, perhaps equally romanticized, but quite different. Rousseau appealed to the already existing cult of sensibility, and gave it a breadth and scope that it might not otherwise have possessed. He was a democrat, not only in his theories, but in his tastes. For long periods of his life, he was a poor vagabond, receiving kindness from people only slightly less destitute than himself. He repaid this kindness in action, often with the blackest ingratitude, but in emotion his response was all that the most ardent devotee of sensibility could have wished. Having the tastes of a tramp, he found the restraints of Parisian society irksome.
From him, the Romantics learned a contempt for the trammels of convention, first in dress and manners, in the minuet and the heroic couplet, then in art and love,
and at last over the whole sphere of traditional morals.
The Romantics were not without morals. On the contrary, their moral judgments were sharp and vehement. But they were based on quite other principles than those that had seemed good to their predecessors. The period from 1660 to Rousseau is dominated by recollections of the wars of religion and the civil wars in France and England and Germany. Men were very conscious of the danger of chaos, of the anarchic tendencies of all strong passions, of the importance of safety and the sacrifices necessary to achieve it. Prudence was regarded as the supreme virtue. Intellect was valued as the most effective weapon against subversive fanatics. Polished manners were praised as a barrier against barbarism. Newton's orderly cosmos, in which the planets unchangingly revolve about the sun in law-abiding orbits, became an imaginative symbol of good government. Restraint in the expression of passion was the chief aim of education and the surest mark of a gentleman. In the Revolution, pre-Romantic French aristocrats died quietly. Madame Roland and Danton, who were Romantics, died rhetorically. By the time of Rousseau, many people had grown tired of safety and had begun to desire excitement. The French Revolution and Napoleon gave them their fill of it. When in 1815 the political world returned to tranquillity, it was a tranquillity so dead, so rigid, so hostile to all vigorous life, that only terrified conservatives could endure it. Consequently, there was no such intellectual acquiescence in the status quo as had characterized France under the roi soleil and England until the French Revolution. 19th century revolt against the system of the Holy Alliance took two forms. On the one hand, there was the revolt of industrialism, both capitalist and proletarian, against monarchy and aristocracy. This was almost untouched by Romanticism and reverted in many respects to the 18th century. This movement is represented by the philosophical radicals, the free trade movement, and Marxian socialism.